when a client says like, oh, I'm really bored with my food, I'm like, good. I hope your food is boring and your life is interesting. Let's go.
The most energetic, fit, and stress-resilient people on the planet practice daily habits to keep their hormones balanced, their gut healthy, and their muscles and mind strong. Welcome to That Fitness Couple. We're Mike and Corey Beth Lepowski, founders of Pure Physique.
This podcast is designed to provide you with everything we've discovered and continue to discover about nutrition, training, and lifestyle. Today, we all live hectic lives.
So we've made it our mission to make your fitness time efficient and to build you up. Hope you share and enjoy. Let's dive into today's episode. Let's go.
All right, guys. Well, today we are talking food addiction, food sobriety, and nutrition mindset with our guest, Mary Roberts. Mary coaches people to heal their relationship with food and overcome self-sabotage. Mary, welcome to That Fitness Couple.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so we're really excited about this conversation. I mean, nutrition mindset is definitely for Corey Beth. It is, yes, it holds a very special place in her heart. And, you know, we think that your message is incredible. But before we start getting into some of these topics, I mean, let's just learn a little bit more about you. I mean, how did you, you know, what was your journey to get to where we are today?
Okay, well, I am currently 52 years old and I've been in recovery from food addiction, bulimia, and compulsive eating for 10 years now. It's something that I've battled since I was a teenager. So, you know, in a nutshell, I started using food as a coping mechanism. I grew up in an alcoholic home. We moved at a time where, like, we moved states when I was like 13 years old and it was like very stressful. And, you know, I had to make new friends and, I wasn't confident and just food became my thing. And I had addiction modeled for me. You know, my father was a recovering alcoholic. My mom has her own food addiction issues. And so, yeah, I was just kind of like, I learned to use food to like for comfort, reward, entertainment. And with all addictions, it progressively gets worse. So by the time I hit senior year in high school, I'd already been hospitalized for bulimia, treatment. I went to a treatment center. It was like 6 or 8 weeks. And that was my first experience with eating disorder treatment. And then from there, it just kind of, you know, from that time all the way up to age 42, I battled my weight up and down, you know, binge eating, particularly carbs, you know, the processed foods, the things that most of us are kind of drawn to. You know, I got married, divorced, married again, had some kids. And even though life was good, I always had this like, I don't know, like there was this dark cloud over me of my eating disorder and not liking the way that I felt or the way that I looked and not being able to get off that roller coaster. I tried every diet possible, you know, everything from counting calories and Weight Watchers, Nutrisystem. I even did Richard Simmons Deal a Meal, like all of these, you know, different things. And if there was an infomercial for it, I tried it. And I just was stuck on that roller coaster for decades. And then a friend of mine, when I was 42, I already knew like I had issues with carbs and I'd tried Atkins a couple times and had moderate success, but never reached a goal weight or anything like that. And a friend of mine whose son had epilepsy told me about keto. I'd never heard that word before, but I thought, you know, why wouldn't I give it a try? I've tried everything else crazy under the sun. And it was the first time in my life that I was dieting, but didn't feel like I was on a diet. I wasn't suffering from hunger. And so I think that's what made it different from all the other things, because certainly when I decided to try that, it wasn't the first time I'd felt like I was at rock bottom or crying about, you know, the struggle and will I ever be able to lose the weight? You know, what's wrong with me? And so the fact that it was easy to stick to really paved the way for me to finally do the work of recovery to fix my disordered relationship with food. So that's why I say all the time that keto saved my life in terms of all the health issues I had. I had type 2 diabetes. I was on medication for that. I was on medication for high blood pressure. I had psoriasis, which no matter what medications they gave me, it wouldn't clear up. I had asthma and allergies, sleep apnea. I snored. Keto healed me from all of that. But it didn't, you know, in and of itself fix my eating disorder. It was just the vehicle that finally gave me the mental wherewithal to do the work I needed to do. So, and now 10 years later, I'm still, you know, my Instagram and Facebook is still Keto Mary. And by all means, I am, you know, keto by default. But these days, I just call it food sobriety. I eat real food. I eat food that nourishes me. I eat food that serves me well. And it just happens to be keto.
So let's talk about that transition for a moment. You know, you had gone for help with your eating disorder, right? And how is that treatment that you got different from what ultimately broke things open for you? Because, right, you know, I've gotten to listen to some of your podcast and listen to bits and pieces of your story. And I think that at first glance, somebody listening to you talk about, you know, those who on the eating disorder end of the spectrum, right? Those who coach people on it, you almost have like a glaringly different approach than they do. I mean, your outlook is completely different. So you went through that system. What is different about what you did to break free, as well as how you help other people break free?
Yeah, I don't take a popular position on it, and I get, I don't know, like, for lack of a better description, hate mail from people, you know, who work in the ed community. Unfortunately, it seems like people who treat eating disorders can't acknowledge or don't acknowledge that food addiction is real and that it exists. Or if they do, they don't, they have this like weird idea of addiction. They don't really like understand addiction. And, you know, so for me, one was always too many and 10 was never enough. And so, you know, having grown up in an alcoholic home, and when, and my father going into recovery, and he was in AA till the day that he died, you know, I understood that addiction meant when you were trying to like get sober, you couldn't drink at all. And you couldn't, you know, drug treatment too. You can't do drugs at all. And when they go into treatment, they are told you can't ever drink again. You can't ever do drugs again. They don't tell them, oh, well, you know, we're just going to show you how to drink, to stick to drinking a couple beers on the weekend, right? They don't tell them that because they know with addiction, it's not possible to just have a couple drinks and walk away. So unfortunately, in the ed treatment community, they kind of have the mentality that the solution is everything in moderation, which sounds great, right? Like, what addict doesn't want to hear they can still use their drug foods? Like, they can still have their, use their drug of, you know, choice, but be normal. And so that's what I was always trying to do my entire life. Like, I was trying to, you know, comply to this, to diet protocol that I wasn't capable of complying with because I was eating mostly, you know, sugar and hyper palatable processed foods. And I forever thought I was broken because I didn't seem to have the willpower, the discipline, or want it bad enough because I couldn't eat one donut and walk away. And so, you know, all these, having, you know, all decades of experience trying to do that, and then realizing, you know, on keto that the cravings had been removed and I, you know, no longer felt physically compelled to eat, you know, it took me a while to get to there. Like, the first year, I, by all means, like, I was looking for low carb, you know, muffins and low carb desserts, and I would eat Atkins bars and stuff like that. But finally, one day I realized, because I had found this recipe for, it was like low carb blueberry muffins, and the recipe made 6 muffins and they were like 2 carbs each. So in my addicted brain, I was like, these, I can eat all 6 for only 12 carbs. But then finally, one day it dawned on me, it is not normal to eat 6 muffins at once. Like, I don't like feeling this way. I want to be like out from under this. And so I finally just started to like make the connection between not being able to have, there's certain things that I just couldn't have, or I would feel compelled to keep eating them. And so my program is called Food Freedom. And if you go to hashtag Food Freedom, most of what you see is in line with the whole everything in moderation crowd, where the message is, you know, we'll teach you, you know, food freedom means you can have one donut and go on with your life. Except that, you know, that when that is the narrative push, and there are people who have tried that over and over and over, like as if it hadn't occurred to us to try to eat just one, right? Like, I've tried that a million times. And when that is the message being pushed, you feel hopeless and broken, like, you already know you can't do this. So, you know, where does that leave us? We'll never be well. And so I just find my definition of food freedom is I no longer even desire to eat those things. Like, the work that I've done has, like, you know, taken away that desire, because I know what the consequences are. I know what it'll do to me. And I know 100% I am incapable of having just one. Even if, and this is where, like, our voice of sabotage gets tricky. Even if on one day I could eat a donut and stick with just eating one and not eating several more right after, that is like this false sense of, like, oh, look, I can eat one. But guess what I'm doing the next day? Well, I'm going to have one again. And the next day after that, and the next day after that. And before you know it, it downward spirals back to six donuts at once. So, you know, I think sometimes people think that they can moderate because they have these little experiences of, you know, one day eating just one. But true moderation is not eating one serving of your drug food every day. Like, true moderation for people that are really, really moderators is they go to a wedding and have cake, and they don't have cake again until their birthday, right? They're not looking for cake every day or once a week.
I resonate so much with your message, and I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. People need to hear this, you know, because I think we have this toxic view of food. But when you compare it to alcohol or a drug, all of a sudden we're like, oh, it makes sense. I think a lot of people can grab onto that idea. Like, logically, that makes sense. My question for you is, growing up with a mom who struggled with eating, what did you see and experience as a child? Because I think that plays so much into our own relationship with food. So I'd love to know what that was like.
Yeah, well, I saw that my mom was a chronic dieter up and down. And I've talked about this before in other interviews. Like, my mom she belonged to this support group called TOPS in the 70s, and it stood for Take Off Pounds Sensibly. And she would take me with her because I was too little to be, you know, left at home. So week after week, I would go to these meetings with her and see women stepping on the scale. They would get this handout, which was a chart for them to, like, write down their food and turn it in every week. And so I mean, that was like my first exposure to the whole, you know, idea of weight loss or needing to change your body. And I remember asking, like, I don't know what it was, but, like, I wanted my own piece of paper to, like, write down. I was like, can I write down what I eat? And I certainly am not, like, blaming my mom or blaming, like, these groups or anything. But I think, like, you know, at 6, 7, 8 years old, seeing that really had an effect. Like, I don't think that if I hadn't, you know, had that kind of exposure, I might not have developed an eating disorder. Although there were definitely, like, other things, you know, when I would read the teen magazines, and I've always been a little bit more, like, on the curvier side. So I didn't look like this, you know, the stick thin girls that were in the magazines. And so I think all of those things combined kind of affected my mindset and kind of warped my perception of what I should look like.
Really, I very much appreciate a lot of the language that you use when you describe what's going on in people's lives with respect to food. The fact that, you know, you talk about food sobriety, that mm-hmm. you talk about drug foods, because I don't think a lot of people position it that way. We have a very sensitive, politically correct way of trying to talk about food and to make it as if, you know, eating this way, which for all intents and purposes is unhealthy, eating foods that are unhealthy are okay because it's food, right? It's not alcohol. It's not drugs. It's not gambling. We don't view it through the lens of people destroying their own health and their own lives and the lives of everybody around them. It's just food. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, talk to me about, like, a little bit about the language that you use. Again, especially, I love the term drug foods. So yeah. Is that something that you came up with, or, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if I invented it. I just kind of, like, just started calling it that. I might have heard it somewhere in circles somewhere. But yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, because I get a lot of pushback from people who say, well, you know, it's not the same with food because you have to eat to live. Well, yes, certainly we do. We can't cold turkey stop eating the way that you stop eating, you know, taking drugs and drinking alcohol. But that doesn't mean we have to eat everything on the menu. Like, just because we need to eat to live, I don't need donuts to live. I don't need pasta. I don't need rice. There's, like, certain things, like, I don't need that to live. I need a certain amount of nutrient dense foods that serve my body well. And so anything that doesn't serve me well, or that I feel compelled to binge on or drawn to, I call them drug foods. And I also get a lot of pushback about, oh, well, there's no such thing as bad foods. And they always talk about it like when we say good and bad foods, as if it's something that has to do with morality, which completely doesn't make any sense. Like, food is not this like living, breathing thing that has morals. There absolutely is bad food. I mean, there's a difference between a steak and an Oreo. So yes, there are bad foods, and you define it as bad as if you eat it and it exponentially raises your insulin and blood sugar, or it gives you a headache, or gives you a stomach ache, or makes you feel compelled to like eat 10 or 20 of them, that can clearly be called a bad food, and morals has nothing to do with it. It's if I have a negative response in my body and my brain, then it's obviously not good for me.
I can get on board with that. Mike was joking. He's like, don't ask her about good and bad foods, because I'm always of the mindset, like, I don't like to say good and bad because of that morality thing where people are like, oh my gosh, it's bad. I'm like, does it align with your goals?
Does it make you a bad person?
It doesn't. Exactly. Right? But right. Like an Oreo, first of all, you're right on. It's not food, right? It's going to do all these terrible things to us. And so listen, if your goal is to be tired, fatigued, skin, gut issues, and feel like garbage, hey, you know, like Oreos are your jam.
Yeah. Yeah. So that said, let's talk a little bit more about the food sobriety aspect of this. I heard you once talk about the difference between a lapse and a relapse. Mm-hmm. And I think this is important too, because, you know, in that realm of drug and alcohol addiction or gambling addiction, you know, these terms are used, they're not used loosely. It's you're having a relapse, or that's a lapse. But once again, within this conversation around food addiction, food sobriety, we don't hear that much.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, those of us that are disordered with food, you know, have had this long past of being disordered with food. We're also disordered with other things. We get obsessed with the numbers and all of that. And so, you know, when alcoholics, they get like their chips, right? Like their 1 year chip, 2 year chip, you know, and they're counting the days of their sobriety. And so I use an app, you know, to do that. And so, but we like to latch on to these numbers. And so our voice of sabotage, if we have what I call a lapse, where let's say you go to the wedding, you have the piece of wedding cake, but you catch yourself. You're like, okay, I shouldn't have done that. That didn't serve me well. And I'm choosing, you know, I'm going to choose not to continue down the path. I'm stopping it right here. That's a lapse. You don't have to start your clock over, you know, like, because our voice of sabotage wants to keep saying, like, when you do something like that, oh, well, you blew it. You screwed up. You may as well like have all the things now. And because you have to start over anyway. And so it kind of keeps us stuck in that cycle. So whereas a relapse would be, you have that cake and then you go home and you eat all the things. And then for the next several days and weeks, you can't get it back on. That would be a relapse. So, you know, for me, I like to keep the definition of food sobriety simple, because again, our disordered brain wants to have all these rules and guidelines. Like, this is when I work with people, when we talk about what food sobriety means, I have to constantly remind them, it's not a diet. Food sobriety is not a diet. Food sobriety is not a list of rules and all these things you have to check off your list every day. And if you miss one of them, then you're not food sober. You know, we are that perfection. Like, also, like those of us that are disordered, we also have that like perfectionist mentality too. And so we think everything has to be done perfectly. So for me, food sobriety is just simple. I eat real food. I eat nutrient dense food and food that serves me well. And there's no other like rules to it. Like, you can throw, like, some people are like, well, but I emotionally eat. Okay. Yeah. It's going to take a while. You're probably going to emotionally eat when you're newly food sober. And, you know, we have layers to our sobriety, and we can only tackle one thing at a time, because, you know, when you have this list of five things that you're trying to do at once, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be able to do all of it and succeed. So the first, you know, rule of food sobriety is just get the food, you know, just get what you're putting into your mouth right. Just eat only real food. And you can, when you feel really solid in that, and you've been dealing with some stuff, you can then tackle emotional eating later. Or maybe you want to add fitness, and in the beginning, that's just too overwhelming for some people, and it could derail them trying to like workout. And I love working out. I think it's, you know, fabulous and should be part of our life, but maybe not in week one or month one of food sobriety, unless you, you know, unless it's something you've already been doing in a routine you've established. I think trying to like do too many things at once derail people, and then they don't get to know what, you know, truly being food sober is, because they're trying to do all these things at once, when just focus on the food at the beginning and keep it simple. It's not a list of rules.
With respect to people who are going through this process, I mean, when are they recovered? I mean, do people ever recover? Or, I mean, what is the end point here? Or is there one?
So there's no finish line. I've seen people use the word recovered, but I think that it becomes a danger zone. If we get complacent or grandiose and forget like where we've come from, that totally opens the door for that voice of sabotage, and people relapse when doing that. So recovery is a journey. It'll be over the day I die. And that doesn't mean that it's always hard. Like in the beginning, just like, you know, alcoholics in the beginning, they struggle. It's not fun when you first get sober. And it's the same thing with food, like, because we're not just addicted to the food. We're addicted to the roller coaster, the chaos that comes with the food. That, like, how many times have we started something and we're like so excited? We're like, oh, I got this new program. I'm so excited. We're always like chasing that, you know, shiny new thing. And so when we get food sober and we're not like chasing all these things, life feels kind of boring, feels hard. And that's one of the things like we have to learn to deal with. So it's, you know, it's not just the food, it's all the chaos that goes with it.
You unpack that a little bit more for people, that we're addicted to chaos. How do you see that either maybe in your past or in clients you work with?
Yeah. So, you know, we go through the stages of grief. And so when we give up the carbs and the sugar, which we've always thought we can't live without, and, you know, it gives us that dopamine hit, and so we're always like, we're looking for that high, right? And we see people, I was just reading something on Facebook, and the language that they use, someone asked about peanut butter, and this girl who's a coach, she said, well, when I need a peanut butter fix, I will use PB2 or whatever. Like, she had this recommendation, but I thought it was interesting. She used the word fix, and that's really like what it is. You know, we're always looking for that high. And so when we get food sober, we're not getting that. And like I was saying a minute ago, we get excited about trying something new every time, like, you know, we're always looking for like the next best thing. Well, with food sobriety, this is the best thing. There's not going to be something that's better than this. The answer is abstaining from your drug foods. It's not this new program that came out. It's not, I should say, like the shots that everybody's doing right now. They're like so popular, right? That's not going to fix their relationship with food. So even if they're successful with stuff like that, they're always going to be, you know, starting something new. Like I joined Weight Watchers a gazillion times. I did that, you know, but it never worked because I had to keep, you know, going back. So if you have to keep trying something new, I just think that's part of the addiction, like, because we're always looking for something to be excited about. And frankly, food sobriety can be boring, and we have to find other ways to drive our entertainment. Like for so many years, my life revolved around food. If we went to the movies, we were eating. We went out to eat for entertainment. It wasn't about the conversation. If you go to a wedding, oh, I wonder what food they're going to serve. Go to a potluck or a pic, like everything is about food. And I was always excited about what food was going to be there. Well, when you're not eating that stuff anymore, like you have to figure out how to get excited about something else. So now it's like, okay, well, I'm going to this event where there's going to be food. I wonder who's going to be there. What interesting conversations am I going to have? What am I going to learn? And so that's what I mean by like the chaos. You're always looking for, like, you have to learn to live life without getting the excitement from the food.
Hey, we hope you're enjoying our show and finding it valuable. If you could do us a quick favor, it would mean the world to us. Please take a moment to rate and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Your reviews help us reach more people and share our message. Plus, we'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks for being awesome and supporting us. Now, back to the show.
So tell me if you agree with this, that if somebody is a chronic dieter, that they find themselves constantly jumping, as you described, from one new thing to another because the last thing didn't work or it worked for a while, it's no longer working today. That person, before they could even consider another diet per se or changing their eating habits, really the first thing they need to address is the fact that they probably have a food addiction. And that until they address the mental components, nothing that they try, even if it is keto, carnivore, even if it is the answer, it's still not the answer.
Right. Right. So I think this is where, like, why I always say, like, nutrition matters. I don't think people can recognize that they're addicted. Like, a lot of people can't really recognize for real that they're addicted to something until they try to give it up. And so nutrition plays a huge role in recovery because, you know, there's like 12-step programs and stuff out there, and they talk about, you know, getting out sugar and flour, but they fail to recognize what we all know is that all carbohydrate, no matter what they are sugar. Does that mean we have to be carnivore? No, but we do have to acknowledge, like, the science that when we eat carbs, it elicits a certain response in our body. So in order to get that feeling of satiation and not, and that have that white knuckle feeling going away, you have to have the nutrition part right so that your brain, you know, the brain fog lifts and you have the mental clarity to be able to understand, like, what comes next.
I love that so much. And again, what you've uncovered in yourself with mindset and help other people to do, I think is beautiful. We have an episode coming out about the headline with Oprah and Ozempic. And I just think it is such a dangerous thing that all of our lives, we've watched Oprah do this diet, this diet, this diet, this diet, up, down, up, down, up, down. And now using a platform of great influence that she has to present shots to people, I'm like, this is really, really a dangerous territory we're walking into. And, you know, I can't speak for her because I don't know her personally, but that's someone who has not overcome their food addiction, and she's on to the next thing and presenting it as the answer to millions of people. And I just can't help but think that that's not a great thing.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, you know, because they're all, like, it's very popular right now. Like, what is it going to be like 3 to 5 years down the road with these people? Because, I mean, it's very obvious. People are definitely having weight loss success, but if you don't address the issue with food, I mean, what, you're going to take these shots the rest of your life? And I don't know enough about, you would have to, right? Like, and I don't know enough about them to, like, really talk about, like, what the dangers are. I've only, you know, heard a few, like, talking points, but I just know for me personally that, you know, that wouldn't have been the answer, because, you know, anything that you stop doing, you know, anything you do to lose weight and you stop doing it, of course the weight's going to, you know, come back on if you aren't dealing with what caused you to gain the weight in the first place.
Yeah, I can't remember which celebrity it was. It was a male celebrity who also recently commented how he had gone on Ozempic, but he's now regaining all the weight back because he did not learn how to eat. It didn't change anything about his eating habits. And you said people are having success with it in terms of weight loss, but we know that weight loss is not the solution. It's all about fat loss. And a large percentage of people are losing muscle.
I got a prediction. Yeah. My prediction is 5 years from now, we're going to see those commercials on TV that are, you know, did you or someone you know use Ozempic? Like, do you have brittle bones because these people are not getting the nutrients they need? Do you have bowel obstructions because we know that it slows the passage of food through our intestines?
Or liver disease.
Liver disease. Tumors. I mean, oh my gosh, I can only imagine what that's going to look like 5 years from now. Maybe 10, but that's my prediction.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think we're going to see a lot of that.
One thing that you had said before, which was really interesting, when you mentioned that person on Facebook who wrote about her peanut butter fix, like, it was so interesting. It took me right back to, like, the bodybuilding days where that also was the mindset. It was like, well, if it fits your macros and I want to make sure that I'm eating lower fat, so let me use PB2 in a protein shake or on its own, spread that on a rice cake instead. I mean, it's like, it's crazy to think about now, but it's so interesting because we all have this association that, well, it's okay to have it just as long as I do this version of it. And we're not addressing the underlying issues. Whereas today, I don't even consider peanut butter a thing anymore. I mean, I can't remember the last time I've had any, and there's no desire. But it's just interesting too, because you take foods like that, foods that many people will deem as being, well, that's a healthy food. It's a healthy whole food. and not recognizing that there is still a good degree of processing that goes into it. And we know based on research, the way our body absorbs the nutrients as well as the calories from peanut butter versus whole peanuts is vastly different. And yet, you know, we just think that these foods are okay for us. And yet there's an addiction to those foods. I remember waiting for my peanut butter fix. You know, it was like, is it 12 o'clock yet? Can I have my next meal? Can I have something? And it was like, you're right. It's like that mentality around when's the next meal coming? What's that meal going to look like? And the only way to truly address it is, though, through those nutritional interventions. So as much as we are talking about the mindset component, this is really where keto comes into play, carnivore comes into play. And now you're eating in a way that's providing your body the nutrients it needs so that it doesn't feel triggered to have these cravings and what have you. So where also, I mean, I know keto had been what you were doing and you're still doing today. Where does the nutrition conversation, though, often come in with you and clients that you're working with?
Well, I mean, it's an ongoing thing with most of them. And it really depends on like where they're at. Like I work with a lot of people who they're familiar with keto. They've done keto, they've done carnivore, but they haven't been able to stick to it because of the, you know, the mental piece or trying to like do a commercial version of keto, which I don't want to like dump on like dirty keto. I think that it has its place, especially for people trying to overcome food addiction. And so I call some of these things like transition foods. So like I just had my 10-year anniversary. What I eat now looks nothing like what I ate year one, except for the fact that I still eat bacon and eggs and meat, right? Like, but there's a bunch of stuff that I would eat in year one that I would never eat now. And so I think, you know, some of these things, they serve their purpose as transition foods. But when we work on the education about nutrition, because a lot of people, they'll say, if they're not familiar with like keto or carnivore, and they come across me somehow, they'll say, well, I eat really healthy. But guess what their version of healthy is? You know, it's like the mainstream narrative of heart healthy whole grains, low fat, you know, like low calorie. And so sometimes I have to like work with people on, you know, just having them unlearn what they think they know about nutrition, you know, and then having to teach them true nutrition, which is, you know, and a lot of them think that like red meat is bad. So they'll eat chicken and fish and stuff. And I'm like, you'll feel so much better if you have a steak. So I just recently was working with a lady who hadn't eaten red meat in like 8 years. She was only doing like chicken and meat. And suddenly, like she just like started craving steak, and it took her weeks to where she felt like she wasn't binging on steak. It was like her body needed to catch up. Her body needed like all those nutrients. And then she finally like felt satiated for the first time in forever. So anyway, the nutrition conversation is ongoing because there is so much that we're told that, you know, I can't bombard people with everything at once. Like, you know, we got to take like one thing at a time.
Baby steps. And I know Mike always feels better when he eats a steak too. So, you know, science, just kidding.
No. So within this conversation though, around nutrition, I'm sure a lot of people, when they're coming to you, the reason is not just because they want to get over food addiction. Same reason why they come to us. You know, the big goal is fat loss. Right? Yeah. I want to look a certain way. And so we start to break through. They're starting to make some progress towards eating in a healthier manner, eating whole foods, whatever that looks like for them. Yet they're still struggling with fat loss because there's still some overeating component to it. So what do you do in terms of addressing that? Because one thing that we personally saw for the period of time that we were doing keto, and then we had some clients transition over to it, this pattern, tell me if this sounds familiar, they make the change, they start seeing some great success, and then they get cocky and they get a little lax. When they started keto, they were doing it perfectly. They were doing it with whole foods, but then suddenly it's, hey, fat bombs, hey, more butter,
keto cake,
more this
keto
than
bed,
that.
Bread.
And
yeah.
You see it also with carnivore. You know, people have initial success and then things start to slow down because either they're getting cocky or not recognizing that there is still like some thermodynamic component to this with regards to fat loss. Yet we don't want them going down the Weight Watchers route. of counting all their calories. So, I mean, right. How do you address that intersection?
So, first of all, I let people know it's clear I'm not a weight loss coach, but a lot of the people, I would say the majority of the people that I work with, one of their goals is definitely weight loss. But, and then also just depend, like most of the people that I work with have a lot of weight to lose. And then there's some who don't have very much to lose. And so if we put, so when it comes to weight loss, there's lots of things that we can do that fall into like the diet mentality box, I think, you know, even though tracking macros is a great tool and using the scale is a great tool and getting a DEXA, like all those things, like I can definitely talk to people about those things. But when the emphasis is on that, they lose sight of food sobriety, which is where the being grandiose and cocky comes in. Everybody also has a honeymoon period. And so with my program, I make it clear, like you can't just ride on that and think that, you know, when that is over, that you're going to be able to deal with what's coming. And so that's a mistake people make, like when they first start keto or carnivore, you feel really good. It all of a sudden it feels easy and you don't feel the normal pull. But again, that's part of the high of doing something new. So they're really excited. They're seeing results, but then the honeymoon period ends, real life sets back in. And then, you know, they're in danger of relapsing. And so we have to do even though it's when it's feeling easy, we still have to do the work. We can't just like ride on that high. You still got to be, you know, doing the work of the program every day to keep your mindset in it, because that honeymoon period is going to end.
Where I think as a coach, it's so important to keep people grounded. As much as we always want to celebrate their successes, it's also, I think, recognizing that, hey, this is what's coming down the road. And you need to be aware of it and looking for those warning signs, like when people do get overly excited. Like I'm always very cautious of the person who is over the top happy, over the top nice. I'm like, you have a dark side. You know, you definitely have a dark side that you are not showing right now. And God help us all if we're around when that happens. And I think it's very similar, though, on this nutritional front as well. People will say, oh, I'm doing perfect. Everything is great. This is so easy. And then it's like, that seems to be the person that the moment they get triggered, the moment something happens in their life, it's like, yeah, it's like a relapse to the nth degree.
Yeah.
They won't know how to deal with the danger zone. So like I've had to have lots of hard conversations because I come across this a lot. Like the first 4 weeks I'm working with someone, you know, they're flying high and they're feeling really good because like they feel like it's working, and it's a fine line. Like I want them to be, you know, excited and feel, you know, the excitement of the results. And so I have to have a hard conversation without like bringing them down. Like, this is going to pass. Like, it's not always going to feel like this. And so we got to be prepared for, you know, when this excitement ends. And it's usually somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks that they start to come down. And so my message to them is, we're not focusing on, I know you want to lose weight and there's nothing wrong wanting to lose weight, lose fat, get in shape. Like nothing is wrong with any of that. And there's nothing disordered about wanting to take care of your body and get in better shape, but that cannot be your top focus. Your top focus has to be being food sober, because without it, you're not going to get those other things. And if you do get those other things, you won't keep it because you haven't gotten your mind right yet. And so that's the conversation, is every day the goal is food sobriety. And as a result of food sobriety, these other things happen, like it trickles down. So someone that needs to lose 100 pounds, 150 pounds, they don't need to do macros. But if they want to lose 25 pounds, then macros will probably really serve them because it's like a tight, you know, they're closer. But if they're still like full blown in, you know, their ed brain and they don't know how to get themselves out of a danger zone, tracking macros isn't going to help them, because their voice of sabotage, the first time they go over their carbs or any of the metric, right? The first time that it doesn't look perfect on their MyFitnessPal, that voice of sabotage is like, well, you screwed up today. You may as well eat all the things tonight and start over tomorrow. Like it's all, you know, that voice always comes in when we're not perfect. You know, it lets us know that we've screwed up and this is a good time for us to like, you know, have the last hurrah or something, because there's this magical time in the future where it's going to be easier to try again.
Love so much how you frame it as a journey, because I do think a lot of people expect, you know, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to arrive and everything's going to be easy. In fact, we had a client we worked with for about a year reach out, and we always try to paint that next picture, you know, like this could be coming, this could be what you experience next. And she's like, oh my gosh, I feel like so ashamed. And I'm like, I've been waiting for your call. Like, there's no way that it's been so easy and so perfect and everything else. So my question is, what are some of the symptoms or signals that someone has entered the danger zone? And then maybe if you could share like one or two of your strategies to help them come back out of that danger zone.
So we have, there are multiple danger zones. So in my program, a danger zone is a situation where in the past, we have historically like derailed, fallen off plan, quit the diet, whatever language like you want to use. So, you know, that could be a fight with a spouse. It could be, you know, a bad day at work, a pet dying, or, you know, any like type of event that would have sent you to food for comfort and all that. And so, I'm sorry, say your the last part of your question again.
Symptoms or signals of entering that danger zone and strategies to come out.
Yeah. So when you start to, so just in general, like signs of being disordered with eating are you lie about what you eat or don't eat. You hide food, you eat in secret, and you do, or if you, anything, a behavior with food that you feel embarrassed or ashamed of or guilty about, you know, that those are all, you know, signs that something's not right. And, you know, what I teach in my program for how to get out of those situations, like to be able to overcome that voice of sabotage in any situation is first, you have to accept that you are indeed disordered with food. If you think that your problem is just you haven't been disciplined enough or you haven't wanted it bad enough or you just have no willpower, that's not what's wrong. Like what's wrong is your disorder with food. So that first step is like really, you know, acknowledging that we're disordered with food. And then the next step is knowing what your danger zones are. Like look at your history. Like what are things that have sent you to food? Like you're looking to food as the solution. So it's all those things. Like their danger zones can be people, places, events, smells, you know. So I had one, you know, I've had clients that like have people in their life that every time they interacted with them, they like found themselves like looking for food when they left, you know, the environment of that person. And so, or going to the boardwalk and smelling a waffle cone, something like that, right? Like those are like memories that can put you in a danger zone. So we got to identify the danger zones. So that we, because if we know what the danger zones are, we can see them coming and we can recognize when we're in one. And then that the next step is realizing that when we're in a danger zone, we're going to hear from our voice of sabotage, you know? So it's going to start telling us that food is the answer, that what we need is, you know, we need to treat ourselves. We need to live a little. We need like it's sending us to the food. And so that next step is, you know, listening for that lie. What is it we're going to hear from that voice? And then once we know what we're hearing, the next step is to fight back against it. So when we hear from the voice of sabotage, it's almost always a lie. And so what do we do when we hear a lie in general? Like if we have the TV on, we hear lots of lies on the TV. When we hear a lie being said, what is our reaction? Generally, we're like, that's not true. That's BS. And then we start saying what is true, right? So we have to react to the voice of sabotage in the same way. That's not true. Here's the truth. And we do that over and over. And then we don't fall for like the same things anymore. So like, for example, in year one for me, the grocery store was a huge danger zone because there's my drug foods everywhere. And at the checkout was always where it would really get me. You know, because they have all the candy and everything there. And I was, you know, candy was one of my drugs of choice. And there was always like these little coupons, you know, 3 for $1. And so that would be a huge danger zone for me in year one, getting through the checkout and, you know, not partaking in that because my voice would be like, oh, but they're 3 for $1. Like, you know, you could get 6. And now when I stand at the checkout, I don't think maybe 100% of almost 100% of the time, I don't even notice that there's candy there because I just don't care. It doesn't call me. So my voice of sabotage doesn't, you know, use that one anymore, like because I'm not going to cave to candy. But where my voice of sabotage these days tries to get to me is like at the gym, you know, like, oh, why don't you look like her? How come you, you know, like the talks to me about other things, not food, because it can't get me with food anymore.
Wow. That's so powerful. I appreciate you sharing that so much. I know that those statements help so many people because we always feel alone when we think those things, you know, like you suck, you failed, give up, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter. You're not pretty enough, good enough, thin enough, all the things that happen. And I love how you combat it. It's to me, it almost feels like spiritual, like get behind me, Satan, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Fighting back out loud is, you know, super important, which is awkward, you know, sometimes, but like, you know, I've heard, you know, my voice of sabotage will, you know, will say, oh, you should like fill in the blank. And so, and my response will just be, what? No, I used to do that, but I don't do that anymore. And I will, you know, I'd have to say that out loud because we hear the voice of sabotage in our own voice. So we have to speak the truth in our own voice to like override that.
Have you ever heard the voice of sabotage in someone else's voice?
Oh, yes. I call them agents of Ed. the other people that say what Ed, so Ed is the eating disorder voice. So like I started using voice of sabotage as a more generic way to describe it, but I still call it Ed. Like, so when, you know, people say things that Ed would say to me, I call them agents of Ed. And they do, they say, oh, but it's Thanksgiving. Just have a piece. Just one. It's a special occasion. Live a little. And I started, my response to live a little started becoming, well, I have no interest in living a little. I want to live a lot. I lived a little myself up to 260 pounds and lots of metabolic diseases. I'm not interested in that.
Probably shuts people up real quick. I mean, that is totally like, oh. a me response. Like that, I love it.
I already had diabetes. I don't want to go back. Yeah. Thank you.
Right. You know? Exactly. So yeah. Good. When people ask me like, well, do you miss bread? Do you miss cake? Like I feel like if I were to say I missed bread or I missed cake or any drug food, I'd also be saying I miss fat pans. I miss diabetes. I miss psoriasis. Like it's all connected for me.
I want to know, I mean, I love the study of the gut and how food impacts us. So for you to struggle with psoriasis and so many of the things you described, if you can remember, because I know we're like a decade now, about how long did it take for you to begin to see improvements in things like your skin?
So about 18 months. So initially, like it's the one that came, the result that came the quickest was the type 2 diabetes. Like I was off my medications within a couple of months. And actually, like the first couple of weeks, I got my blood sugar under 100, which I couldn't believe it. But a couple of months in, I was off like all those medications. And then it took about 18 months for the psoriasis to go away and for my cycle to become normal. And I don't know at what point I stopped snoring, except that my husband, you know, stopped nudging me at some point. I don't remember how long that took, but yeah, those, the big two, the what took the longest was the psoriasis and the having a regular cycle.
Amazing.
Let me actually, since you brought up your husband, we know that support systems are incredibly important in order to be successful in this journey. So, I mean, number one, how supportive was your husband when you started this journey? I mean, is he following what you follow? What is that at home look like?
So initially when I, you know, when I was introduced to keto and started, I was silent about it because even though he was never really like, he was never really mean about my weight and, you know, he didn't say things. He had said one time, you know, that I had told him about a diet. I don't even remember which one, but basically like it became like the eye roll thing because I was a professional dieter with like no real results ever to speak of. So when I started keto, I didn't say anything to him because I didn't want the eye roll. But now, like, he's one of my biggest fans. He, like, tells people, you know, about my story all the time. But also, he is someone who's a true moderator, but he, with food. But he is also a recovering alcoholic and been, like, 15 years sober. And the only way I could get him to understand what it was like for me was because he would always say things like, I don't get why it's so hard. Well, you know, just have one. And I was like, oh, did you ever just have one beer? Like, I would never say anything until then. Finally, I'm like, this is the only way he's going to get it. And when I said that to him, then he made the connection. Oh, yeah. Well, what would be the point of one beer? Like, right. What's the point of one cookie? That just makes me mad. You know, like, So he's a true moderator with food. He's a huge support for me. So are my kids. My oldest son is like always sharing my posts on Facebook, and they all have dabbled, except my middle son. But my oldest son, you know, he's done keto and carnivore. My youngest son has done it. My husband did keto for a while, but he always struggles to, he's never had a weight problem. So when he did it, he lost too much weight and he was mad about it. So he stopped doing that. But yeah, they're all familiar and they've all tried it.
Awesome.
I mean, I think it sheds light to something that's so important. And it started this whole conversation that food addiction is no different than any other addiction. And it's just hard for the general population to accept that or to realize that. I mean, here you have it in your own home. He could see that you've struggled with this for so many years. And yet when you bring it up that this is an addiction, it's like, really? You know, it's almost like that sort of, and not saying putting words in his mouth, but it is that sort of mentality or attitude about it. Like, how could that be a problem? It's just food. Yeah. And yet once you relate it back to, you know, his own addiction, it's like, oh, okay. Like now I connect the dots. And I think that if we were able to have that conversation with people more openly, when people are challenging us about our food choices and why we're eating this way. I mean, listen, I am by nature a moderator, but she knows that I'm an abstainer by choice because I don't even want to consider what would happen if I tried moderating in this particular area of my life. And there are for me, I mean, alcohol was something that I tried to moderate, but even though I was never diagnosed as being an alcoholic, I know that it would always get to a point where I could recognize, hold on a second. Now I'm 7 days in a row where I feel like I have to have a drink every single night to settle down. This is not going to go in the right direction. And then learning to shut it down right there. But I know that in that respect, I am the rare individual, just like your husband is the rare individual when it comes to moderating food. More people, I believe, just need to recognize where, in what aspects of their life they are one or the other.
I am not. Yeah. I am like you very much. And I'm an overachiever. So one scoop of ice cream was like, might as well finish the whole thing because why do you want to leave that? Right? Like completely. Right. So,
Well, and unfortunately society doesn't take food addiction seriously. And when you use the term eating disorder, the first two things that come to mind for most people are anorexia and bulimia. They don't see, all the other behaviors and stuff that falls under that umbrella of eating disorder. And we're bombarded with, you know, like the food commercials and all the different, like, it's amazing to me. Like, I've seen so many things like over the last, you know, decade, like, I don't know, like 30 different flavors of Oreos. Like I would have been all over that before. Right. So it just, to me, it feels like, and maybe I'm just noticing it more because I'm food sober, but the processed food seems to keep getting more and more ridiculous. And it seems to be like acceptable. You know, like the food addiction or being, you know, eating all this stuff is like normalized. And so therefore people can't take it seriously. And it's bizarre that when you say, I only eat real food, that people think that that is weird, you know, and I've been asked so many times, well, what does your doctor think about all the meat that you eat? But they never once asked me, what does your doctor think of your Cocoa Pebbles, your Pop-Tarts? Your Hershey bar. Like, no one ever asked me that. Like, why is that okay? But meat is somehow a concern. It's just bizarre, like how, you know, and it just shows like the power of marketing and all of that. So I hope
because our society is part of the problem. I mean, you know, we recognize the problems with others in terms of alcoholism, drug addiction, because they make up such a small percentage of the population. But when the majority of the population actually falls into this category of food addiction, nobody thinks anything of it. Because when you look around, everybody else is like you.
Right.
We're all the same. So why would this be a problem? And then just to speak to the, you know, 30 different types of Oreos, going back to the drug example. You need a new drug to capture people's attention.
Well, I think that the food marketers have never tried harder to get people addicted to whatever it is. I mean, look at the flavors of Doritos that we have today. Are you kidding me? Like, back in the day, it was nacho cheese and Cool Ranch. And that was pretty much it. Then we got spicy. But now it's like, how many flavors do we need to keep coming up with? And I think that logical eye is like, they're trying really hard to hook people.
Absolutely. Which makes you mentioning that there's actually a book called The Dorito Effect. And it's all about how they make the food addicting, like how they put so much money into like researching different combinations of flavors and colors to get, you know, the bliss point of work so that people will continue to eat them.
Meanwhile, cows just graze in fields and we still make the same steak and it's still good.
Yeah, I know. Right. But that to most people is boring. And that's the challenge is people will look at a keto or carnivore lifestyle. And the first words, at least the first words that we usually hear come out of their mouth is, I couldn't do that forever.
Yeah.
Like I can't do that forever. And it's like, well, why do you think that? And it's because they start rationalizing in their minds all the things that they're going to lose.
We're so overstimulated. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like in media, how, remember we used to have YouTube where we'd sit for a 20-minute video. And then it was like, okay, only like five. Then it was three. Then we had vines. Now we have GIFs or GIFs. You know, it's like the shortest amount of time that we need. It's the same thing happening with food. It's got to be so sensationalized. We're like space Oreos with triple thick icing. Like, oh my gosh, you know, I got to have those.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's one of the things that I work on with people, like, is like, we have to get our entertainment and excitement from things other than food. So when a client says like, oh, I'm really bored with my food, I'm like, good. I hope your food is boring and your life is interesting. Because we cannot, you know, if we have to get entertainment from our food, or we think that life is going to be less than because there's a certain something we don't eat, we need to evaluate the rest of our life. Like, I've had people tell me, oh, I couldn't live without bread. Really? Like, what if bread disappeared tomorrow? You're telling me you wouldn't want to like go on with your life? Like, look for other ways to get excitement.
I quote you on that. I like that a lot.
I like that too. And it also shows how much people put their identity in food.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a pizza eater, or, you know, like, I'm big time when it comes to my pasta. It's like, you are identifying yourself with a food. You know, I mean, we believe our identity comes from God, so we don't worry about pulling our identity from anywhere else.
It's a very confused society we live in.
But it really is. And identity is just getting more confusing.
Yes. Well, that said, I mean, we want to know where people can find you. First of all, if you have not visited like your Instagram, which we will totally put in our show notes, your GIFs, memes, they're so funny. I'm like, this is so good. So entertaining and educational, but tell us where people can find you.
Well, on Facebook and Instagram, I'm at KetoMary71. My website is foodfreedomwithmary.com. And I have a podcast called Food Freedom that's on all the platforms.
We will be sure to link all of that in the show notes. Any closing thoughts,
Mike? No, I mean, I thought this was like a great conversation, really enjoyed it, and love digging deep on this side of nutrition, because I think it's an understated and under-talked about aspect. Yeah. We just tend to look at diets and focus on the nuances of nutrition and want to argue back and forth about what's the best way to eat. When at the end of the day, I mean, people can have success on lots of different types of eating plans, but none of them are going to ever be successful unless we address the fact that we may have a food addiction that needs to be addressed and taken care of. So just thank you so much for bringing, you know, all of your expertise today and insights. It was awesome and we enjoyed it a lot.
Thanks so much. I did too. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. If you're a busy working parent like us, you understand the daily challenges. Our mission is to make exercise and nutrition simple and exciting, helping you and your family thrive even on the busiest days. We've got a fantastic free 5-day online challenge that's tailor-made for super busy people like you.
If you like a high-vibe workout environment with professional coaching, swing by one of our franchise studios for a free intro workout.
Check the show notes for details or head on over to purephysique.com when you have a moment. We know those moments are rare.
Until next time, lift weights, eat meat, and never forget, you were created on purpose for a purpose.
Beef. It's what's for dinner.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.